Please stand by. And now, the Principal Financial Group Women in Business Teleclass Series Number 4 with your moderator, Ms. Jane Berenson. Please go ahead, ma'am.
Good afternoon and welcome to the Principal Women in Business Teleclass Series. I'm Jane Berenson, the editor of Inc. Magazine, which we call the Handbook for the American Entrepreneur. The magazine exists to help business owners become more successful and to help and encourage people considering life as an entrepreneur to take the plunge. Today I'm serving as the moderator for this exciting program, so let's get started. Thank you for taking the time to call in today to the teleclass brought to you by the Principal Financial Group. We hope that these classes conducted over the course of the year help give you an edge in growing your business. The Principal is committed to your success and is here for you should you need any help with employee benefits for your employees or individual financial services for yourself. Just give the Principal a call at 515-362-0112 or visit principal.com/teleclass. We'd like to make things easy, so don't worry about taking notes. Information about this class and all previous ones is available at the same address, principal.com/teleclass. And feel free to call in during our live Q&A for 15 minutes following our speaker discussion. To queue up early, simply press star 1. Okay, so today we are going to hear an inspirational story on one woman business owner's multi-million dollar success story. Do what you love, the money will follow. From Kim Kleeman, the founder and president of Shakespeare Squared. Kim started her career as a teacher, but along the way she discovered a different part of the education sector. Kim made the jump to the business side to develop Shakespeare Squared. It is a full-service educational company that creates everything from textbooks to lesson plans to websites for publishers. Shakespeare Squared, based in Glenview, Illinois, is mostly comprised of women. After a three-year, 815% growth spurt, it is now a $2.3 million company. Visit shakespearesquared.com to learn more about Kim or her company. Now, the mission of this class is pretty simple. By the end of this session, you will take away savvy business pointers to grow your company and stay passionate. Without further delay, I'm thrilled to introduce Kim. Hey, Kim.
Hi, Jane. How are you? Thanks for having me today.
Yeah, thanks for being here. Well, I think we should start at the very beginning, just like Julie Andrews in The Sound of Music. don't say Doa, dear.
Okay.
But we know you started out as a teacher.
Mm-hmm.
What made you decide to go into business?
Well, that's a great question. First of all, just a thank you to Jane for having me today and to Principal Financial Group for inviting me to be part of their teleclass series. This is very exciting. I was literally in the classroom 5 years ago teaching high school English, and my husband is a math teacher currently in Lake Forest, Illinois. We started to, we were very happy with the two-teacher life, but we started to have kids and realized we were never going to be able to afford some medical issues and also child care for all three of our children. When I was pregnant with my second daughter, my husband went into student teaching, and we didn't know how we were going to actually pay for him to not work during that semester. And so we started doing some freelance writing for Pearson Scott Forsman on the side. My mom actually worked for the company, and she said, you know, we always hire teachers. You should do some work for them. Well, we ended up taking a project that was, they told us was for two people, a math project where we answered math problems to make sure there were no errors in the textbook. We ended up needing 13 people to work on that project, so we hired my husband's entire math department where he was student teaching, and I started managing them. And we realized quickly that this was a great way for us to be part of education and at the same time make a little extra money. So since I had come from a family that owned businesses, and although I never wanted to own my own business, I saw a unique opportunity for me to make some of our family dreams come true.
Well, you know, that's interesting to start as a freelance project, you know, and expand and grow a company from that. I think a lot of people, the idea of starting a company is just overwhelming. But that kind of stepping, you know, one toe in the water was smart. Would you agree with that?
Yes, I would definitely say when people ask me how we started the business, I didn't have venture capitalist dollars. I didn't break into a 401k. We literally had two nickels. That was pretty much our life. We were really struggling to make a mortgage, and we had a baby at the time. So for me, we worked on some projects as a freelance team and saved up that money and then decided to incorporate and really take that dive. And I quit teaching. And I had to convince my very conservative numbers husband that, you know, if we took this risk, and I always said it, if we, you know, jump off the cliff here and we're holding hands, we'll land on soft grass. And I really had to convince him of that. But at the same time, that gave me every incentive to succeed because I knew I could not fail him with this risk that we were going to be taking.
Yes, well, that's huge, and you didn't fail him, did you, Kim?
No, he's very proud of me.
I bet he is. So what was it, you know, how do you go from being, you know, an employee to employer? I mean, it's such a different skill set.
It is. For me, a couple things really stood out. Number one, my parents had owned bakeries and delis when I was younger, so I saw what it took to be a boss. I saw people stealing, you know, it was a retail store. People were very tempted to steal. People.
You mean
really,
customers or do you mean your employees?
Customers and employees.
Uh-huh.
So really understanding that even the most trusted employees may be tempted in difficult times in their life, or they may leave and go somewhere else and quit or be, you know, poached away. I saw a lot of things that, you know, were the sort of the darker side of business. So I didn't enter in naively. On the other hand, I also started my personal work career after I didn't work for my parents' bakeries. I was a waitress, and then I was a teacher. And both of those skill sets are very independent. You work as a team, you have a boss, but you're sort of on your own to think, you know, think forward, think behind, and think in the present. And it's a real multitasking skill set. And I was really good at that, and I saw that right away. And then I think that just transferred for me as I started to grow a team of freelancers and also then a team of employees, that I was, again, always, you know, thinking about what the history was, thinking about where we were going in the future, and operating in the now. And so those are skill sets that I really honed over the years.
Well, it's probably, it's also interesting that you were a waitress and a teacher, which are service careers.
Mm-hmm.
And did that give you an appreciation of what, you know, employees and customers, their attitudes might be?
For sure. I mean, nothing will let you know how poorly people can be treated until you're in a retail or a service situation. I distinctly remember when I was waiting tables that I had a man who was very frustrated with his meal, and I was trying to make it all that much better, and he mumbled under his breath, "Why don't you go get a college education?" And I turned to him, and I looked at him, and I said, "Sir, I'm waiting on you so that I can pay my way through college. Thank you. And I will have a college education." But regardless, neither of my parents had college educations, and they made a wonderful life for themselves and a very successful path for themselves. So I think I always have learned that when you walk into a situation, to quickly read what that person's needs are, because you can attain them. And with a student or with a customer as a waitress or in the retail setting, you're constantly surprised by what you're approaching as you walk into that. So that really makes your EQ that much higher, really understanding what's going on.
Absolutely. So how did you, I mean, the 800% growth rate you had over 3 years, you were on the Inc. 500 list, which is a list of the fastest growing companies that Inc. magazine publishes every single year. And 800% as a 3-year growth rate is really amazing. So number one, congratulations to you. I will say that not many women on the list, I think partly as a consequence of both not applying, but also because they have businesses that are perhaps they want them on purpose to grow less. How did you grow so fast?
Sure. Well, thank you. And the Inc. 500 list has been one of the most wonderful awards because it's given me instant credibility in the business arena across any industry. So it's been really, really fascinating to see a lot of people's eyebrows go up when they hear that we've made the Inc. 500. When I decided to finally move the business out of my house, I started it in 2003. That's when we incorporated. By 2005, I had two babies, one after another, so I had three children. And I realized as I was on conference calls with New York and changing dirty diapers at the same time, and my mom was now retired from Pearson Scheffler's and trying to help me maintain some sort of sanity, I really saw that I had to separate these boundaries for myself. I never pretended that I really wanted to be a stay-at-home mom. I always was a person who wanted a career, and I finally moved into an office literally across the street from my house. So I'm within a two-minute world. My children's school, my house, and my office are all within 2 minutes of themselves. So we moved out, and I had two employees, my mother and one other teacher that I brought with me to start learning how to do the business of writing and editing and educational publishing. And we started taking on projects, and we started building our team slowly and surely. But, you know, there's a taking risk. I didn't have budgets. I didn't have a ton of money in the bank. I didn't really know exactly what I was doing, except for that I knew we were providing quality materials. The reason we really grew fast is not that we were a company that wasn't out there already. There were plenty of development groups in educational publishing. And it wasn't that I was bringing a unique skill set, because that was already there in many different facets. But what I think that we did was we used our teacher backgrounds and we created quality materials at a great price, not low. We were still, you know, competitive. But then the key was that we always exceeded our clients' expectations. Talk about where customer service comes in. I always tell my staff here that if we can just exceed even 5 or 10% above what somebody expects, they're always going to come back to us. And then, and this was an anomaly in the industry, we actually got it done on time. And as a teacher, I can't believe that deadlines are blown like they are in the business world, because, you know, we teach our children that they have to turn in their homework on time, and then I walk into an industry where deadlines are blown off left and right, you know. So I really had high expectations that we would never blow off deadlines. We would always make those on time.
So right away you were exceeding the expectations right then and there.
Yes. And then I think we're also a very innovative, creative group. So we're problem-solving daily, and our clients have come to rely on us for that.
So tell me, who are exactly, you know, tell me about one of the projects you do so that, that both I and the people listening can get an idea of exactly what your business does. Can you just describe a project and a customer? You know, you don't need to use names, but...
Sure. Well, I'm always happy to. We are really proud of our clientele, and we really focus on a couple different clientele, but our main clients are the large educational publishers like McGraw-Hill, Pearson, Houghton Mifflin. We would do an 8-month project to a year-long project writing a textbook for them, and it could be any grade level, any discipline, because the way that our model works is that we hire freelancers and we customize teams of specialists who write the materials or edit the materials, and then in-house we do the quality assurance. So that if there's 20 writers on a project, our clients think it's all one person because it all is seamless and it's the same voice and it's done in a great process that we've established. We also work with trade book clients like HarperCollins.
Just going back a bit, so sure. Someone might say, one of these publishers might say, we need a social studies book for, you know, fourth graders in Texas?
Yes, exactly.
Okay.
And then they give us all of their requirements, their style guides, and we learn it, and then we just write. We'd write a ton for them.
And then each state has different requirements. Is that true?
Yes. So No Child Left Behind is part of the reason why we grew so quickly, because customization became something that the entire educational publishing industry had to adapt to. So writing textbooks for all of the major adoption states, that's Texas, Florida, New York, South Carolina, states like that, they have very strict standards of what you need to do in order to get on their list to get sold. open territory states, Illinois is one of those where I'm from, school districts and teachers can buy anything, anywhere, and they can apply their money that way. So that's wonderful, except for that if you are one of the few publishers to make the adoption list on those adoption states, you are guaranteed market share. So there's big money there.
Did you happen to look into this, or did the program, or did you know about this program and that there would be particular demands for your service before you started?
No, I kind of got desperate when I was pregnant with my third. My friend who was teaching and writing with me said, "Listen, Kim, I've made $7,000 this year, and I still have to pay taxes on that. We've either got to do something big here, or I got to go back to teaching. Like, I can't live on this." And I'm looking at it too, thinking, "Oh my gosh, me too." So I had this big fancy guerrilla marketing plan. I crafted a paragraph email about how we were teachers who wanted to write quality educational materials, and then I went and got joined an association and got email addresses of editorial directors at all the different publishers and emailed it to them. And that's how I started my client base. And
So the email worked for you? You got
responses?
Well, that's interesting.
And it wasn't fancy, and it wasn't going into spam, because it was just me personally, as like, you know, just emailing somebody personally, and I got a lot of response. HarperCollins was my first one. I mean,
and
who
so you wrote, specifically to the right person at these various places.
Exactly.
Yeah, I think a lot of people make the mistake of just kind of blanketing and not being personal. So you'd say being personal is key.
For sure.
Yeah.
For sure. Getting a personal connection in there, and then I always would tell them that I would do something small for them, you know, do a sample for free or do a small project and show them what we could do so that they would trust us with something bigger. And that was a great way for us to get into an industry in which vendors were distrusted because the publishers had been burned so many times by freelancers who kind of flaked out on them or didn't provide quality content.
Right, interesting. So how many projects do you take on a year, and you know, how many employers and freelancers do you have?
Well, we've grown to an amazing 25 employees in-house now, and we have over 500 freelancers that work on projects for us, and we receive between 10 and 20 resumes a week. We have a very detailed vetting process. We ask our freelancers to take some tests to make sure that their skill set's equal to what we need, and then we put them into our database and we match them to projects as they come. We have anywhere between 15 to 35 projects going on at any one time, depending on how large the projects are and who our clients are. And so that goes all year long. When I decided to diversify out of educational publishing and move into trade book publishing and now also move into non-educational companies, toy companies, computer web companies, web-based companies, that way we never have to worry about the cycle of educational publishing as a state is changing their standards and there's no funding, or a state budget has been put on hold, which affects the entire industry. So I really diversified myself. Most people criticize me because they say I don't have focus, but I think that it's a smart move because we are looking at ourselves as really content delivery group. We can write content for anybody and deliver it any way you want. And
a toy company, what would be the content for that? And why would teachers be, or do you get different freelancers to do that?
We would use different freelancers for that, but at this point we've really built up great sort of, you know, customized teams that write for different audiences. Let's say that it was a company like Hasbro, and that they wanted new questions for a new game. Let's say it's CNET or Trivial Pursuit or something like that. Or maybe they need those fact-checked because, you know, those have to be actually accurate. So there's a lot more need for valid, high-quality, engaging content, and that's what we do.
Oh, that's excellent. So as you take on these new projects, how do you finance them? Do you finance them out of you know, your old projects and profits, or how do you actually afford to expand, I guess my question
sure.
is.
Well, it's hard. We've been growing so fast that managing growth has really, you know, people think, oh, that's a good problem. People say to me all the time, those are good problems. But they're still problems. Managing growth is where a lot of companies start to falter because you run out of money. So for me, we kept our profit margins high, and that was the only reason I entered into this business in the first place, was that my profit margins are high. But I took that money and cushioned any projects that went, you know, over budget or maybe weren't as profitable as we thought they were. So I always use the previous project's money, but then in our contract negotiations, we have different categories of clients, but for the most part, we ask for a certain percentage up front as seed money or grant money in our contracts. And that's pretty regular practice in our industry.
That's great. So you get paid a bit up front, so you're not carrying it until people decide to pay their entire bill.
Exactly, and when that happens, that's troublesome because I do not want to pay my freelancers late. The main thing for us is that I really treat my freelancers just like I treat my clients, because in our industry, they may become our client next week. They get hired by McGraw-Hill because they're tired of the freelance world or they've been looking for a job. The next thing I know, they're calling me for a project and they're the ones paying us. So we really treat our freelancers well. We have a rising stars list. We have a hot 25 list. We send handwritten notes. We call people. We have one employee dedicated as an advocate for the freelancers to negotiate prices and work for hires within our company. So we really treat them well, and because we don't pay them late, regardless what happens with our clients, we've kept our best freelancers, and they pick our projects first.
That's fantastic. Now, are a number of these freelancers for your educational one also working as teachers, or are they people who have been teachers and have gone out?
It's a great combination. We have some stay-at-home moms who were teachers or in the educational field. We have some active teachers. We have a lot of professors who are looking for some extra income. So we have a lot of professors who teach English or rhetoric or different things like that. We also have a ton of professional freelance writers who work in many industries, and because they're just fantastic, you know, authors, they can pretty much write in any genre in any way that we need. The educational factor is key, though, and we have to have people really understand what educational writing is like. And I know later on we'll be talking a little bit more, but, you know, I ended up starting another company to address that because we have so many people that email us with their resumes and want to be part of what we do, but they don't have any training, and that's always been a real issue in the industry.
Let me ask you now that you know, you have a health care plan for your employees and other benefits and some interesting benefits. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Sure. Well, since I was, you know, hosting conference calls with babies at my house, when I finally moved into some space, and we've expanded three times. We started at 1,600 square feet. We're now at 9,000 square feet. When I was able to build out, the first thing I built was a working parents' office. That's not anybody's office, but my employees are able to bring their children in, and we do not pay lip service to that. We have children here almost every day, and it doesn't bother everybody, and everybody who's hired in knows that that's part of the deal here. Mothers, fathers, freelancers, whoever needs that room can take it. We also have wonderful flexibility options. We not only allow our employees to set their own hours, but we also allow for our employees to work remotely one day a week, and also we have full-time remote employees. So we create programs for our employees so that it works with their lives. Maybe they have a mother at home who needs some care that they have to watch. Maybe it's that they want to stay home with their child after they had the baby, different things like that. Our health care became an issue because my oldest daughter has juvenile rheumatoid arthritis, and I really saw my husband's HMO program through his school that dealing with the referrals with all the doctors was a full-time job for me. So meanwhile, my friend Susan, who started this company with me, she got pregnant, and she ended up having a baby with Down syndrome, and she was looking at state insurance, and she was going to have to travel to Wisconsin border and all the way on the other side of Chicago for doctor care. So I quickly started looking at really great, high-quality health care. And that's expensive, as everybody knows, but I really feel like the way I look at it at this point is that it retains and attracts those employees who really can understand that that's a perk at this point. point in this society. And for me, I feel personally strongly that that should not be something that people have to, work really hard for. Health care and health insurance are something that I think should be a given. So we've made great strides. In fact, our rates just went up. And instead of us putting that on the employees, we were paying 50-50. We're now paying 60-40. And the reason we did that was so that we could retain and attract our employees.
Well, it's so nice not having to worry about, where your doctor is located and whether or not you can afford this. That probably pays you back in terms of just stress levels going down.
I agree, and if we're going to stay competitive against our corporate clients, which are really where we lose employees to, the only way we're going to be able to stay competitive is to offer a wonderful benefits program. Many of our young employees that are coming out of college and universities right now, they fully expect for that to be part of their package. So in a time when everybody's pulling benefits out, if you have very specific skill sets that you need to employ and your staff is your talent, your intellectual property, you have to have a competitive benefits package.
Right.
Imperative.
Right. You also go beyond healthcare, though. Don't you have something like maybe called the stress room?
I do. We have a stress room.
I'm going to go there.
Well, this kind of came out. I mean, it was a conference room that I had built at first. And then I realized that when it was a really stressful project we were working on, which happens a lot, that people were either going into the break room and eating chocolate, or they were going into the bathroom and crying, since we're an almost all-female company. And I decided that I wanted a healthy alternative. So we turned that room into the stress management room, and we have yoga classes in there. And on a daily basis, there's meditative music, low lighting, some chairs, some yoga equipment in there. And I just allow a place for my employees to go and take a good, healthy break from the stress. We also have a masseuse that comes once a month, and everybody clamors to sign up with her. And let me tell you, as a benefit, and I say this because I'm very transparent, I'm a very much an open book, but as a benefit, this is one of the best things I ever did, and it cost me $85 for 1 hour a month.
Yeah, that's great.
It's so worth it.
And I love the idea that people can work from home one day a week as well.
Yes. And that's key, especially because a lot of my employees, well, half of my employees commute from Chicago. And that commute during construction season is exhausting.
Right.
And I'm not willing to move my business to Chicago yet because I still have young kids.
Right.
And I want to be near them. So my compromise is that I give them the ability to work from home so that they get a break from the commute.
You know, one of the interesting things about, there are a lot of interesting things about you, Kim, but one is your whole relationship with your family and your best friends.
Mm-hmm.
And I think a lot of people think it's, not a good idea to work with family, not a good idea to work with friends, but I think you've proven otherwise. tell us about this amazing thing.
Well, it's funny because when you look at my company, I don't really think of it as a family-owned business. Most of my clients don't even know that many of the people they're talking to are related to me in one way or another. But my mother, Kathy, is my VP of operations. She's really the brains here. She solves all of our clients' problems. My sister works for me. She actually acts in that advocate role that I talked about with our freelancers. My sister-in-law and my best friend work for me as my office manager and my director of HR. And many people think that that's a really dangerous model. But I look at it this way. Number one, I've always grown up with working in family business, so I know the downfalls of it. But there's also a good side, which is that I already know what their strengths and weaknesses are. I don't have to wonder where we're going to have to work on things. The other part is that it's very clear that I'm the boss. And I say that in a sweet way, but, I can't have it where there's mixed messages. And everybody here knows that I expect for them to grow and to work outside of their comfort zone. And so, my relatives and my best friend would tell you that they are not, there is no nepotism here. They are held just as accountable as everybody else. I also have employed two former students who I taught when I was teaching, as well as many people that have been referred through friends. So my whole staff here really has sort of a family feel, and at the same time, I believe, and I do get feedback the same way, that many of my employees do not feel that that's even an issue. So it's really a bonus for me.
You know, we've written a number of stories at Inc. about partnerships that have failed. And I think, you know, what you said about you being the boss is really
mm-hmm.
important. You know, a lot of people, when they start companies, naturally they want to do it with someone else.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes you get into a relationship where, you know, it's kind of 50-50.
Sure.
And at some point, you know, one person becomes more engaged, is better at the business, you know, for a variety of reasons, you know, should be the boss and the CEO. But the
yes.
kind of legal structure and the emotional structure that started out
mm-hmm.
Doesn't really allow for that. So you just decided,
right.
you know, Miss Boss, that you were bossy.
That's right.
that you were just going to do it from the very beginning and that it was going to be very, very clear.
You know what? It's a great example is that since my best friend Katie is my director of HR, you know, the main thing that I see her role being is that she's really somebody who's keeping my culture here and hiring in the right people for what our needs are. And she does a wonderful job at that. But also, her biggest weakness, and I told her I was going to share this with all the people listening today, but her, you know, her biggest weakness is procrastination. And in a world of retaining and recruiting employees, that's a dangerous thing to have.
Mm-hmm.
So she and I talk about that regularly. We've put things in place, like bringing a calendar to every meeting and putting reminders on Outlook so they pop up and remind her that she's supposed to be doing things. And I've helped her grow, just like if I look at how I was as a teacher, that I helped my students become the best that they could with the skill sets that they own and they possess. And I look at it that way. I don't begrudge her anything because she has some weaknesses. Of course, I do too. And people tell me what my weaknesses are every day. But, you know, and I work on those things. So that's really important that you keep the communication open. And I'm not all about passive aggressiveness. I'm sort of one of those on the table kind of people. So,
right.
you know, if you've got a problem, let's just solve it. It's going to be much easier for all of us if we can do that.
Yeah, so you just believe in being completely open and honest, and some
yeah.
people might say blunt.
Yes.
Yeah. Frankly, yeah. I think it's easier.
I do, too.
Yeah, it just is. But you also have an interesting relationship in terms of how your family acts as an advisor to you.
Mm-hmm.
And I think people might love to hear about how you start your day.
Sure. So one of the great things about my life, since I live in this two-minute world, is that I take my kids to school at 8 a.m. in the morning, and then I don't really want to go into work yet. I don't really need to be at work until 9:30, and I have to literally hold myself back from going into work. But instead, I choose to use that time in a more positive manner. One of the things I do is I go and work out, and my mom and I work out together, and that's really great because...
Now, your parents live...
Just 14 houses away.
14 houses, okay.
Yes. But before we go work out, and every day, we go and have tea at my parents' house. So I drop the kids off, I go to my parents' house, I have tea with them, and my brother, my older brother, comes. I'm one of five, so sometimes some other siblings show up here or there. And it's really an informal advisory group. We troubleshoot a lot of things. Business opportunities, personnel issues, family issues, you know, intrapersonal, and we analyze things. And I know this is unique. I know most families don't do this, but my father being an entrepreneur for 40 years, he had bakeries, he makes cheesecake for Sara Lee now, my mother who worked with him and now works with me, my brother who has a law degree and an MBA and works in commercial real estate, myself, and then my husband and my brothers and sisters who come in and out of that when they have days off or have time to come and have tea with us, we have these most intriguing and inspiring conversations that really start my day off problem-solving and motivated and energized, and then I go into work. And that buffer between being a mom with three kids and the whole craziness of the morning and then moving into that zone where I can just be Kim, I don't have to be mom or boss or anything. In fact, sometimes I get taken care of by my parents and they bring me tea, which is so nice. And then I move into the role of CEO. And I just found I needed to have that buffer because going from the frazzled mom, getting everybody off to school, walking in as CEO, I was coming in so frazzled frazzled and such really, really, really annoying boss because I'd be like running at a million miles an hour before I ever got my day started. So I really forced myself to do that. And then I'm home by 5:30 every night, and I do not work weekends unless there's something very special that I need to do. And those boundaries really set an example for my entire staff. I really think you can get all that you need to get done in a 40 to 50-hour work week. If you're
now,
very
okay,
efficient.
You say that, but,
yeah.
But let's move on.
I know, I do
you
say that.
but you have, you know, some organizing techniques, don't
mm-hmm.
you? I mean,
yeah.
Because I know that it isn't easy fitting everything into a 40 or 50-hour week.
No.
So how do you do it?
Well, I delegate a lot. I'm not a micromanager, and I trust my managers. So I hired good people in, and some of that is just from my intuition and my high EQ that I found the right people for different things. And then I trust them, and I allow for them to make mistakes, and I don't make them scared to make mistakes. That's something that I work on with them all the time. Then I also, I leave my BlackBerry in the car overnight. I do not check my email because I find that I can't sleep if I'm
right.
thinking about things that happened after hours.
That awful email that comes in at 10:30 or 11.
Well, and you know, when I was running the business out of my home, the fax machine would be going off at 3 a.m., the phone would be ringing, because the freelancers worked all hours, and I just found that I was going crazy from that. I also don't travel a lot. My family is not very set up for me to travel a lot. They do not like it when mom's gone. My husband doesn't like it when I'm gone. And so I delegate that out to other employees. Now, I'm lucky because in my industry, many of our clients don't have time to meet or be taken to lunch or anything. In fact, it took me 2 years to get my biggest client to lunch. So I have a unique situation. But I also just don't travel a lot. It's once per quarter is my average.
Yeah, that's smart. Now, when you started your business, I mean, or when people are thinking about starting a business, what are some of the kind of basic questions they should ask themselves?
Well, the first thing I would ask is, why are you entering into this particular industry? It's got to be something you're passionate about, not just because somebody told you there was some money in it or there might be a great opportunity. I think that if you're going to put all this time and you're going to build a life around it, it's got to be something that you live for, and passion is really big. But the other part of it is that you have to really look. I think it's that dipping the toe in the water. You have to really look and make sure that this is going to be a profitable opportunity for you. The risk has to be, you know, outweighed by the fact that you actually see that there's going to be a payoff. And I'm not a high finance person. In fact, I didn't do very well in math at all the way through school.
That's why you married a math teacher.
That's right. But what I did was, in the beginning, once I looked at it, it's 50-50. 50 out to what I paid to everybody else, 50 into myself. And I kept that 50-50 rule until I hired some finance people who could then make it work in different ways. And I know that everybody's thinking, great, if I had 50% profit margins, you know, I could talk like this too. But, you know, obviously that's changed as we've grown and overhead and project changes and pricing and the industry and all those things. But for me, in my mind, it had to be a very simple, profitable industry, and that's why I entered into it. But also, why was my background, was I going to be able to make a splash with my background? And I knew that being a teacher and entering into education was a smart move. I just also had the business mind that went with it.
So you were credentialed.
Mm-hmm.
You were experienced.
Yes.
You had passion.
Yes, and I worked hard. 1 year, my husband and I had 9 W-2s. We would teach, we would coach, we would put our baby down to sleep, and we'd start our next job, which was freelance writing. So you can't be scared of that hard work in the beginning. But on the other hand, now I have my life set up the way that I would like it to be.
How now? Your business is what, about 5 years old? Is that right?
Yes.
Okay.
I built in those boundaries at year 2.
Uh huh.
I built in those boundaries and said, okay, if I'm really going to move this forward, if I'm really going to go to the next level, I can't work more. I have to work less, actually.
And do you take vacations?
Oh, I love vacations. Yesterday I had a wonderful conversation with my management team that it is not good for the entire business when I do not have a break. I lose my vision. I lose my vision. I lose my energy. I lose my leadership skills. I become cranky. I'm not a good leader. So it is imperative. I've started a vacation fund for myself, and it's imperative that I take a break, you know, every 6 months or, you know, even less than that, and just get away for a long weekend or for a week or so here or there, and really, truly not work. If I'm doing this, if I'm building this business, then I sure as heck better be able to go on a vacation and not work.
Well, and do you extend that privilege also to your employees?
100%.
Yeah.
Do not call in. Do not check your email.
When they go away, you leave them alone.
Yes. And when they're on maternity leave, I leave them alone.
Yes.
You know, it's truly supposed to be a break.
Right, exactly. I don't know if maternity leave is exactly a break.
You got to focus on some other things.
Now, I know that you're starting, you know, some other stuff, other companies and whatnot. Do you want to just tell us a little bit about that as well?
Yes. So out of Shakespeare Squared, I started to realize that my staff would be really much more creative when we talked about ideas where we saw holes in the industry or things that weren't going right. So it started off as just like a little meeting once a month, and what I noticed was that everybody was walking away with really creative juices flowing and then would provide better products for my clients. So then we started talking about some real products that we would create, and I started Upgrade Education, which is my second company. It's an S-Corp, and we are a publishing arm, but we're going to be working in the digital publishing industry. We have some podcasts up on iTunes, and what we're looking to do is enter into the arena collaboratively rather than competitively, and we're training our industry so that editors can be trained. And this is where when teachers or friends of friends or my mother-in-law's girlfriend wants a job with us, I nicely show them Editorial U, which is our training program over in Upgrade Education, so that they can start to learn what our industry is about and gain some training skills. So that's Upgrade Education. And then we also have a foundation called the Shakespeare Squared Foundation. And since my husband and I both really struggled through student teaching and did not have the finances to be able to really get through that without starting up this company, we offer student teaching scholarships and also cash awards, where we give money for travel, wardrobe, school supplies, child care, everything you need to have a paid internship. Because teachers go into debt before they actually become a teacher and then have low salaries and live in high-income areas.
Right.
And I'd like to take this on a national level. I'm looking for my first corporate sponsors, and I'm looking for people passionate about making a change in education.
That's really a great idea. Now, how do you fund that foundation?
Well, my husband and I when we started seeing that this business was really taking off, we just started putting our profits into it and creating some scholarships. It was out of our own service. You know, we needed to do something and pay it forward. Now I'm seeing that we could do much more. This is something unique. We haven't seen anybody else doing anything like it, and we'd really love to take it on a national level. And from a business point of view, we see that we can talk our clients into putting things into these student-teacher starter kits that are customized
good idea.
Teachers.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and then we create brand loyalty by giving those to student-teachers, and they start using products in the classroom. So I really see a way to help teachers, but also to further and help our clients as well.
Now, do you ever go out into classrooms and see how your materials are being used?
We do. We actually focus group both in the classrooms, but we also focus group on webinars, too, and have teachers who give us feedback on products that we work with. But because our freelance database are mainly teachers or former teachers, and frankly, my husband and my world are teachers because we both have been in education for so long, we often will hear about products being utilized or go and visit a school and see what's...
Right, so you're getting feedback.
Yes,
from the people who are using it.
Yes.
Okay, well, I think it's maybe time for to hear from some of you in the audience. If you want to call in, just press *1 to be connected with our operator. And Amber, we're ready if anyone is standing by, and you can just break in as you wish. And in the meantime, Kim, I'm going to ask you, what was your biggest surprise? What did you find out about yourself through all this?
Well, I found out that I obviously must have some sort of natural entrepreneur gene. I fought it for a long time, and, you know, many people ask, how do I do this? And I don't really have an answer except for that. My instincts are really good, and I saw my parents run wonderful businesses. So I was surprised to find out that I'm a pretty good entrepreneur. And that I also had this vision for how I would see build my business. Jane, when you and I talked one time, you said to me, which would you rather have, growth or a family-friendly environment? Hands down, a family-friendly environment. If I can't build this company the way I would want it to be, then I don't want to be owning my own business. There's no point in this for me. So I can go back and teach and be fully satisfied and have a great life, or I could build a business that's going to be a model in my mind for how you can really offer a fabulous culture and fabulous benefits for your employees and actually be successful in it.
I think one of the things I respect so much about entrepreneurs is, and you know, envious of as well, is the ability to create something, you know, in your own image. Now, you know, if your own image is, you know, Scrooge, it's a problem. It's a problem. But, you know, if it's to, you know, have a wonderful life, to have your employees have a wonderful life, you know, to create a product that people need, you know, to give back to the community, that sort of thing. I mean, I just can't imagine, you know, a more worthwhile and rewarding life, you know, than that of an entrepreneur.
I agree, and, you know, it's paying off. We won the Working Mother Best Small Companies to Work For in 2007. Right now, we're finalists for two awards, the Illinois Family Business Award and the Alfred P. Sloan Flexibility in the Workplace Award. And first of all, let me just say that those awards, we apply for them. We go for them. I'm not afraid to toot my own horn. I think that's really important, especially for business women owners, that they understand that there's no shame in applying for these and nominating yourself and getting yourself out in front of people, because people should know that, you know, businesses can be run in a healthy, flexible way. And so I say that because what I hear from a lot of women business owners is, oh, my gosh, I don't know how you have the confidence to do that. And my feeling is, well, if you don't do it, somebody else is going to. Somebody else is going to go for it. So go for it.
Yes.
And, you know, a lot of my employees fill out surveys for those, and we get a lot of feedback from those about how high the satisfaction rate is. So that's really great for us, too. Good knowledge.
Yes, I think employees like it when the company does well and is recognized, you know, by third parties. And
yeah.
I agree that I think a lot of women do not, you know, take the time, you know, to apply for some of these awards because they don't want to spend the time, or it seems meaningless, or whatever. But
right.
It's not. I totally agree with you. It really isn't.
I agree. And, you know, Principal Financial Group and Inc. are both sponsors of WPO, which is Women's President's Organization. And the wonderful thing about WPO is that they bring a lot of opportunities to their members. And that's how I learned about the Inc. 5000. You know, they said to me, if you, you know, 5,000 companies, think about how many companies that is. You should go for it. At least plug in your numbers and see what happens. And, you know, what comes out of that is every time that I get a phone call for an interview or anything, I think of it as my opportunity to really share who I am and what my company is about. And I always think of it as my last opportunity to tell people about myself, because I think that that's really how you have to approach PR.
Yes, yes. Amber, I wonder if she's around.
I am, right here.
Okay, do we have any callers?
We do. We'll take our first question from Jenna Rodriguez.
Okay. Go ahead.
Hi, this is Gina.
Hi.
Hi,
and
Gina.
My question is, me coming, you know, from a Latin background, I actually volunteered back in my hometown here in Texas, and I'm curious, any Spanish textbooks in the mix? Just because I was disappointed in college when I saw all these Spanish textbooks, and, you know, all the verbiage is, like, from Spain and not necessarily, you know, the more Tex-Mex yet Mexican language. I'm just curious, is that, was that one of your projects or has been or in the future for you, Kim, and your company?
Sure. Well, translation services are something we offer, and we do it in many languages, but Spanish is our biggest one. We have teams that work for us on the translations, and the key here is that we often have to find translators who also understand the educational value of what they're translating into. Each of our clients asks us to translate a little bit differently, and they have style guides that go along with it. And you're right, they will often have their style meet with the Spanish, with Spain or Portugal as their main targets as far as the kind of Spanish we translate into instead of what they call regional Spanish. And that's something that the states push on the publishers. It's not something that they really get a choice in.
Okay, interesting. Thank you. I guess I never knew that. I knew there was always an explanation as to why it's different.
Yes, and I think that there's so much being translated into Spanish. Everything we do is translated into Spanish. So you'll see a lot more materials coming out in the next couple of years.
Well, good, good. And good luck, and thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
Okay.
We'll now hear from Nancy Ridenour.
Okay, Nancy.
Huntersville, North Carolina. I'm an independent technology analyst. My question is about those emails that went personally.
Mm-hmm.
To the right people. I want to know how large you made those emails. Did you have attachments? Did you follow up on any of them?
I had no attachments. It was just one paragraph. And I did follow up on them. If I had phone numbers, I would call, but it was really hard to get through to, you know, with the large corporations to try and get somebody's phone number or direct line is near impossible. So what ended up happening was that I took those names and then I started attending conferences. Or what I got back was, I'm out of town and you can contact so-and-so in my absence. Well, then I would take that name and then I would contact that person. And so I just kept utilizing that. Today, for those of you that are trying to figure out how to get to your consumers, I really recommend two different networking websites. One of them is inkbiznet.com, which is a great place that I found a lot of contacts, and then LinkedIn is the other one. And if you buy the $50 a month business thing for LinkedIn, then you can type in a company, and all the people who work for that company come right up. And I know the same thing happens on InkBizNet, too, as something that's part of the perk. So I really recommend utilizing those tools, because you can Google somebody's name and figure out. There's also another website called Wink.com that allows for you to type in somebody's name, and it tells you all the social networking websites that those professionals are on, whether it's Plaxo or any of those things. It's so easy to get through to people now if you just do a little bit of legwork in the beginning.
Thank you so much.
I would also add to that you should check the list because, you know, people leave jobs.
Mm-hmm.
And so even if a list is accurate today, it might not be accurate the day you're sending it out.
Exactly.
And it's terrible if you send out an email to someone and it never gets there. So you can call the company and just make sure that that person is still there and has the same title as she or he did previously.
That's a great point. And the other point is then when I would hear back from somebody and they'd say, I remember a funny story, like, are you going to NCTE? And I'm like, sure. And then I had to go figure out what NCTE was. And I realized it was a conference that they were going to. And so I quickly ran and got a ticket and got myself to that conference. And I got a meeting and I acted like I was supposed to be there. But then I also met with a ton of other people while I was there. And I just utilized the names that I had in the beginning and said, oh, is so-and-so here? Oh, they're not? Oh, is there somebody else I can talk to? You just have to really get yourself out there and get past your own fears on this stuff. You have to sell yourself.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
And our next question will come from Bette Rogers.
Okay.
Kansas City, Missouri. I'd like to know a little bit more about your freelancers and how you retain them. I know you talked about your quality of life as far as the business world is concerned, but also not only how do you retain them, but how do you secure them?
Well, this is something that we work on almost as much as we work on closing business deals with our clients. So our process is very simple. We invite anybody to send their resume and some writing samples to us. We then put them through our orientation program, which involves them choosing some tests that they want to take or providing samples on projects if they're already pretty deep in the industry. Once they take those tests, we grade them. We're such teachers here. We grade them in-house, and they have to get a certain grade level. And then if they do, then they go on, and they're put into our database, and they're assigned our freelance advocate who then will get in touch with them and find out what their availabilities are, get them our independent contractor agreement, which I highly recommend for everybody, as well as we give them a work for hire. Now, when we work on projects, the main thing is the freelancers will complain about a couple things. Communication, changing the scope of a project on them so that it's not what they thought it was going to be, and also payment. And those are the three main things that we focus on, is that everybody's clear what the project is, what our expectations are. They've signed the independent contractor agreement. They have their work for hire. And then we communicate with them throughout the project, even if we have to hold them off or the dates change or any of that. And then also we make sure that they get paid on time. And what we do is we ask for invoicing at the end of every month, and then we give them a 30 to 45-day window. And we really do pay within that. The freelancers get burned a lot. And if you can be loyal with that and pay them, even if, you know, there's problems with the project, that may not be their fault. If you can pay them, they're going to remember that. And then when your projects come, they're going to be available for you.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Now, Kim, you also get paid a little bit up front from your clients as well, don't you?
Yes. And we hold that because, honestly, we pay a lot of money out to our freelancers before we get a bulk of the payments from our clients. Our contracts are either like 25, 30, you know, like there'll be payments of 25 to 30%, and that can be in different segments or deliverables or due dates or something like that.
Right.
Newer clients will do 50-50, and some clients we will do 100% at the end of the project, but those are our, you know, fast-paying,
tried-and-true
clients.
Right.
And we keep tight reins on startups or, you know, education companies that maybe are in one niche. We really keep a tight rein on them.
Okay, good. Do we have time for one more question?
We do. We'll take that from Teresa Minicello.
Teresa?
Hi. I was curious about how, at the beginning, when you were starting up and you had your friends and family as your people that you started your company with, how did you really gently, or did you not gently let them know, hey, this is the way it is, this is the structure on the CEO, and this is the way it needs to be in order for it to just not be total havoc? How did
sure.
you do
that? That's a great question, and it's a big one. My feeling is that before I took on my mother as my employee, I gave her a survey, and I asked her to fill it out, and a lot of the questions were, where do you see yourself now? Where do you see yourself in 5 years? What kinds of things would you expect out of me as a boss? What kinds of things do you think I should expect out of you? And how do we set up benchmarks, and how do we keep the communication lines open? And I had her fill that out, and I've had every family member fill that survey out. And so then we met and discussed those topics and said, okay, we have to make a promise to each other that this is how we're going to operate or else this isn't going to work. And there are times where I have to take somebody off-site and have lunch with them and have a heart-to-heart or really deal with some major issues. Having my best friend as director of HR has also helped because we've been best friends since freshman year of high school. She knows my entire family, and so she deals with a lot of conflict and sort of nips it in the bud before it gets to me, too. So that's been really helpful.
Oh, that sounds great. Well, right now my company is so small that it's just me and my best friend, and
sure.
It's kind of like I have to very gently remind her that, listen, you do have to do that.
Yes. And you know what? I still have those conversations, too. I literally just had one this weekend with my best friend, and I said, listen, you can't go and just, you know, as a friend, you can tell me I'm wrong. But, you know, in business, you have to do it in a way that's not in front of all the employees and, you know, doing all these things. And she and I have had many of those conversations. The key is to continue to communicate, and when it starts going bad, talking about whether or not it's working out.
Right.
And really being honest.
Right. Hey, listen, I really appreciate it. It was a very great teleconference. I learned so much. Thank you so much.
Oh, thank you.
Thank you. Well, I think it's time for our conclusion, Kim.
Already?
You have so much good information to tell people, but I think I would say the top three are probably family and friends do mix. You just have to do it in the right way, and you had a million great ideas there. Two, you should have a product that has the potential to be profitable. And three, you know, you shouldn't be afraid of hard work to get the ball rolling.
No.
And with that, I'll say that if anyone missed anything today, the classes are recorded and summarized 1 week after today on principal.com/teleclass. If you like what you've heard, please tell a friend about this class. We hold them once a month. And our next one is on May 27th at 12 p.m. Central Time, and we'll feature Susan Wilson Solovic of SBTV in a discussion with the author of The Girl's Guide to Building a Million-Dollar Business, another million-dollar business. We want to hear from you. Following this program, you'll get an email survey. Your feedback helps us develop future programs tailored to your business needs. And so a big thank you to you, Kim, for your expertise and wisdom. And
thank you.
You're just great. I should say, just, you know, if people want to read more about Kim, we did a wonderful story about her in Inc. magazine, which you can find on the website, inc.com, and just search for her name. And she tells you all about everything.
And they did a great piece on me. It was wonderful.
It's really wonderful. You know, it's chock full of great things. But thank you to our listeners for their participation. And on behalf of the principal, we hope you gain valuable insight on how to grow your business. Log on to principal.com/teleclass for more information and to locate a local principal representative in your market. Have a great month. Bye.
And that concludes today's conference. Thank you for your participation. Have a great day, everyone.